Hi, everybody. It's Dr. Eric Quorum, founder of AIM7. Welcome back to The Blueprint, where we distill cutting-edge science, leadership, and life skills into simple tactics optimized for your busy lifestyle and goals. Today, we're talking about subjects that I'm really passionate about, building resilience and wearable technology. And we are blessed to have Dr. Tommy Wood with us to dig into these subjects. I usually don't read out long bios, but I want you to have an appreciation for who this guy is. Dr. Tommy Wood is a neuroscientist, elite level professional nerd, that's what he calls himself, and a performance consultant to world-class athletes in dozens of sports. Dr. Wood received an undergraduate degree in biochemistry from the University of Cambridge, a medical degree from the University of Oxford, and a PhD in physiology and neuroscience from the University of Oslo. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics and neuroscience at the University of Washington, where his laboratory focuses on brain health across the lifespan, including in babies born preterm, adults who experience brain trauma, and the confluence of factors that can affect long-term cognitive function and risk of dementia. Now, you would read this and be like, oh my gosh, this guy's totally unapproachable. He is so cool, so easy to talk to, and man, we are blessed to have him here. He'll challenge our assumptions today on health tracking and optimization, revealing potential pitfalls and offering a more balanced approach. We'll explore how to use health tech effectively without becoming obsessed, and why building resilience might be more valuable than constant optimization. So let's get right to it. Let's lean in and learn from the best. Tommy, I'm going to ask a question that's very personal because I own a tech company that leverages wearables. But what are the potential downsides of using a wearable device?
One of the both upsides and downsides of like the modern wearable sphere, and I guess the health sphere in general, as it has developed over the past 10 or 20 years, is this vast volume of data that we now have access to, right? And this can be a great thing, but it can also be problematic. And people have probably heard about all the great things that you can achieve with data, be that from, you know, sleep data from your aura, CGMs, heart rate variability, all these things that we can collect, you know, and then also regularly taking blood tests and these other things. Certainly, there's huge capacity for improvement and understanding yourself better with these kind of high density data. The problem is, or one of the problems, potential problems, let's say potential problems, is how people, the individual, say the client, if you're a coach, or, you know, your user, if you're a digital health company, is how they interact with those data. And I literally cannot tell you the number of times where an athlete or a client or somebody else has been given access to these tools and has just like completely spun out from this huge amount of data that they do not understand, mm-hmm. and they don't know what to do with, and often tells them they're doing something wrong and they don't know how to fix it. Mm. So this is the main issue that I see. And there are ways around this, particularly when it's something like sleep data or continuous glucose monitoring data. I frequently see people suddenly super concerned about this data that's coming in. So you've probably heard of orthosomnia. People may have heard of this now, which is the idea that when you track your sleep, you become so focused on perfecting the sleep metric that actually it's a stressor in its own right. And again, I think I know more people who've stopped using sleep wearables than those who continue to use them in an ongoing manner, because particularly when they're having a bad night of sleep, they're thinking, oh, right now I'm not asleep. And then tomorrow morning, my aura is going to tell me that I didn't sleep well. And then that stress keeps them awake longer.
Yes.
And then the other side of that is, in general, the data that you get from these wearables isn't great. Like, it's okay. And it's fine to look at trends over time. Mm-hmm. But when we then use those data the next day to tell us something about ourselves, it impacts our psychology and our physiology from there, based on poor quality data or not great quality data. And there's some really nice research that kind of backs this up. So there's this group at Harvard that includes Ellen Lang, who's a psychologist, and Steve Lockley, who's a circadian biologist. And they did a study where they had individuals in the lab and they had them sleep either for 5 hours or 8 hours. But then one of the things that Ellen Langer has done throughout her career is manipulate clock time and how you perceive the passing of time and how that affects your psychology and your health. So what they did is that they randomized people to be told that they slept either 5 hours or 8 hours. So some people slept 5 hours and were told they slept 5 hours, but some people slept for 5 hours but were told they slept 8 hours, and vice versa. They slept for 8 hours but were told they slept for five. And the thing that impacted their reaction time and how sleepy they were and how they performed the next day was how long they were told they slept rather than how long they actually slept. So imagine when you wake up and you look at your sleep data, which has some error in it, and you're told you didn't sleep well the night before, you will perform less well the next day because of that information, regardless of how well you slept. So the kind of the concern that I have about a lot of these wearables is the data quality. I mean, they're okay. They're okay for trends, maybe not on a day-to-day or continuous basis. But then we look at those data and they inform us, they tell us how we should feel and perform. And it's that that actually dictates how we feel and perform rather than the actual variable that we're measuring itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I actually have a resource online that we built that is back and forth as number one in Google over the NIH on the accuracy of wearables. Mm-hmm. And what really upsets me is the reporting of things like sleep stages.
Yeah.
Which we know you can't really do accurately outside of polysomnography. They're trying to proxy for something that needs EEG and eye movement.
Yeah.
Now, things like duration, onset, those are fairly accurate, right? But I think the most important thing that you said to me was it's telling you how you should feel, and it's not actually asking you how you feel.
Yeah.
And that the subjective measures of wellness are actually a more sensitive indicator to how you're adapting to stress. So I'm 100% with you. As a sports scientist for years in an elite sport, we had to overcome the data component because just because you did a lot of work, let's say you ran a lot on the field, that doesn't exactly mean that you're in a bad state the next day.
Yeah.
Right? It depends on how you're adapting. And human systems are, you know, most of these devices don't look things from a temporal perspective. It's just like one discrete piece of information. So do you personally use a wearable?
No.
Okay. So you have a degree in neuroscience, you have a medical degree. I see that you're a self-proclaimed like performance nerd. You have a wonderful podcast. You work with elite athletes. What data are you collecting from those athletes then to make decisions? Since you're not, I assume you're not with them on a daily basis.
No, I'm not. And often, particularly with the elite level professional athletes, I'm working as part of a team or as a consultant to a coach who is there day to day. So often helping them interpret the data that they're getting, I'm sort of one step removed and helping give them some oversight of the full scope of data that they're able to get a hold of. When you ask whether I'm using a wearable, the answer is no. Mm-hmm. I have used wearables and I've used them in the way that I think that they are useful. One is that I will implement them when I think I need to track something. So say when I'm working with my coach on a particular period of my personal training, I will track HRV to see, you know, as some part of how I'm recovering. Mm-hmm. But also I don't look at those data. I send them to the coach and he interprets them for me. I think adding that level of distance between the individual and their own data and somebody else who can help interpret it for them can really overcome some of these potential issues. Then when you think about things like sleep or continuous glucose monitoring, because those are very common right now, I have used those, but I've used them to better understand myself for a distinct period of time. And then I've incorporated that data into my personal data bank and I've moved forward with it. One of the other issues that I see with wearables is that we offload personal introspection and understanding of ourselves to a device when I think we should be building that ourselves. So
building interoception.
You should be able to understand how you feel and perform just like you said. So I collect the data for short periods to better understand myself and then I continue to update my personal models, because I think we should be thinking about how we feel ourselves. Like you said, the subjective and, you know, your personal experience is probably the most important thing. So that's how I use those kinds of data. I don't just use them continuously ad nauseum. I use them to build a better understanding within the individual, and then they can use that information going forwards.
Okay, that makes sense. With where we're going with artificial intelligence, large language models, the real unlock to me is hardware. So the integration of a niche LLM on a piece of hardware. Mm-hmm. What would your ideal scalable solution be? Because not everybody can afford a coach that can interpret their information. What do you think like the future should look like?
What this really all boils down to is behavior change. That's what we're really trying to achieve, because we know that lifestyle and the environment are the most important 90%+ driver of most chronic disease and health-related issues that the people are struggling with. So what you're really trying to do is help somebody change their behavior, and if they have the means to, change their environment. One of the things that I think most coaches and most people who've been working in these arenas know by now is that more information does not drive behavior change, right? When I started my first podcast more than 10 years ago, I was like, if I just give really good information, everybody will change what they do and they'll improve their health, right? And that just doesn't happen. So I'm not sure that more information is necessarily what we need. I think we need to find ways, like a scalable solution is some kind of integrated app as part of your phone, which is always going to be on you, always going to be in your pocket, that helps nudge you into making better lifestyle choices and changing your behavior in a personalized manner. And I think that AI and large language models absolutely have the capacity to do that at scale, but they just can't yet. Most of it has to be grounded in psychology rather than in data collection. Because in reality, I think I could tell most people the things that they could do to improve their health without much data, and they would see massive benefit if they actually did it. So I think where things are going is, yes, we would need some personalization. We need to understand the individual and their environment and their means. What can they change? And so collecting some data there is absolutely useful. But I don't think that we should kid ourselves that more data is what we need. We need to figure out how to create scalable solutions to support behavior change, because that's what we really need. Because in reality, we probably know most of the answers already in terms of what people should actually do.
I want to take just a moment and say thank you for being such a valuable member of the Blueprint community. Because of you, we get to bring on great guests like Dr. Tommy Wood. And the reason is because of the reputation of the show. And also, when guests evaluate whether or not they want to come on a show, they look at the number of ratings and written reviews. So if you haven't done it yet, please pause right now and leave us a written review and rating on whichever listening platform you are joining us from, as this is one of the best ways that you can contribute to the show and help us grow it and continue to bring on great guests. So funny. You said 10 years ago when you started your podcast, I was part of a group of folks. There's probably three of us that were really the first sports scientists here in the States. And at the time, we actually needed data. This is 2011. Without data, empirical data, to create a model for what I was working in American football, there was no discussion to be had. So it would have been my opinion versus your opinion in a coaching environment, right? We actually needed data to help inform a pathway forward, right? But then it gets to a point where it's like, what do you give the head coach?
Yeah.
Like if you give them this stack of data, they'll like either like put it in the shredder or use it as toilet paper. And then with athletes, I made the critical error that I thought, to your point, that they wanted more information when they really didn't. They just wanted to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And then if I could understand what that one singular problem was and earn their trust and help them solve it, then they would come back and ask for another, you know, hey, can you help me with this? I think contextualization of recommendations is going to be the key unlock for all of this. But I'm with you. As somebody, like, I use a wearable on a daily basis. I know where the flaws are. And even in our app solution, we bury data. Like, you have to dig to find it. Everything at the top is a surface level recommendation for you that like can get you in and out quick. But I've had to learn this the hard way, and I'm really glad that like there's other people that are talking about this. I don't want to dissuade people from wearing their Apple Watch because there's utility in it, but also like I try to do a great job of educating them. And you should check out this resource we have. You just Google accuracy of wearables. Mm-hmm. Like we rack and stack every single wearable out there. And then we like, it's the truth. It's not our opinion, you know, and it hurts feelings, but like, yeah. I like the Oura Ring, but like, I can't sit there and say, look at your REM sleep. Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Like sleep architecture. There's behaviors that you and I can recommend to help get more restful and fulfilling sleep. But I really appreciate your thought process on this. Another thing that I've noticed that you're doing, and I really appreciate this, is pushing back on some of these unrealistic protocols and expectations that are being kind of pushed down from some of the big voices in health and wellness. It's not realistic for most people. Mm-hmm. And I would try to optimize an athlete for an Olympic Games.
Yeah.
Where we're trying to get something done for like a 20-second period of time. But most people can't really optimize everything. What is your take on this and what are you moving towards?
Yeah, I think that using the athlete as a model for optimization is nice because in general, and not for all sports, so say I do a lot of my work in Formula One and the season is almost the entire year and you have to perform on almost a weekly basis. So it's a different approach. But in general, you know, athletes have a shorter season and maybe just one competition, that your main competition that they're hoping to peak for.
Olympic Games.
Like an Olympics, absolutely. So it's one competition in a four-year cycle. And everything builds up to that moment. And with vast amounts of historical data and understanding that athlete, you can get them to their peak at that period of time. What we are doing in the quote-unquote health space, optimizers, biohackers, all these people, is we're trying to create this state of optimal continuously. Like, you can be optimal all day, every day. And there are a few issues with this. One is that we don't even necessarily know what optimal is for a lot of these states and individuals. And the reason I say that is because of how, again, the data are generated. So one thing you might be trying to optimize is some blood tests. And this is something that I've done for a very long time now, and even built companies trying to do this. And say you're trying to optimize something like your HbA1c. That's probably one where we have a pretty good idea where your lowest risk of cardiovascular disease, dementia, things like that are with, say, HbA1c. And that's done from large population data sets. And then you have 20, 30 years of follow-up and see who dies of what. But then we apply that approach to essentially every blood test that you have, and it could be hundreds. And the problem is that most of the data that are used to generate, say, normal ranges or project out disease outcomes come from the average population. And the average adult in the US and most westernized countries has at least one chronic condition and takes at least one medication chronically. And then we stare into those data and we say, oh yeah, where the person has the lowest risk is at this level of this marker. But these people, in general, the average population is very different from the type of person who is trying to use those data to optimize their health, right? They usually don't have any chronic conditions. They're usually much more well-off sociodemographically. They're just different. So we're using data from people who aren't like us to tell us something about ourselves. And we just know that doesn't work. And again, so now 6 or 7 years ago, we tried to build a company that did this, and we used population data to try and optimize blood tests, and I deeply regret it now. But I understand the process so much better. But we had these big issues because we were trying to predict certain things using this data. So we built models with these big population data sets. We then applied those models to predict certain things in the individuals that we were working with who tended to be athletes. And the predictions were just completely insane, because we took a population data set which doesn't look like your average athlete, and we used those data in athletes, and all the models were just wrong. And we spent a long time trying to figure that out. It's just true. All of the models were wrong. So first, if you're trying to optimize something, you need to know what is optimal. Do we even know what that is? And you also need to make sure that the data you're using to generate the models that you're applying to yourself, and that can just be a target range, or it can be something more complicated, is from people who look like you, who have, you know, where you've tracked the outcome that you're interested in. And for most outcomes, we just don't have those data. So we're kind of making these big leaps from the data sets that are available to us when that's probably not relevant. And I've seen that in action.
Did you have money invested in this project?
It was more time. It was a stage of the project that we were at. It was all sweat equity. So I hadn't like invested a huge amount of money into it, but certainly vast amounts of time.
Gotcha.
So then the next thing with optimization, particularly this continuous optimization, is, again, I'll go back to the psychology. How is it affecting you psychologically? I think that there's a potential. So for some people, and I would argue it's a minority of the population, some people can just completely disconnect themselves from their data and the approach, and they do it very rationally. They're like, these are my data, this is what I should do, and I'm going to do it. But most people don't think like that. So if you're trying to optimize something, in order to continuously optimize, you have to continuously tell yourself, I am not optimal. These are the things I'm doing wrong. This is what's bad about me. This is what's bad about my blood tests. And we know that when you think about yourself in that manner, you can negatively affect both your psychology and then, as a resulting from that, it negatively affects your physiology and your health. And this is essentially what happens when we compare ourselves to others on Instagram. We're constantly thinking, I'm just not as jacked as that guy, or I'm not as happy or as rich as that person. And I think on a smaller level, but more continuously, we're doing that when we're constantly searching for optimization, because we're constantly telling ourselves, this is where I'm bad at something. And I think that that can have a net negative effect on our overall health. And then the sort of where I would go instead is acknowledging that, particularly when we're trying to do this long term, right? It's just impossible to be optimal all day, every day. And I would argue that when we try to do that, we're more likely to cause harm than benefit. Because what we really want is we want to be able to perform and feel good despite suboptimal conditions. And that's much more common, right? We want to be resilient to suboptimal conditions. We want to be resilient to the time when we can't get as much sleep as we want to, or, you know, we want to know that we can still perform well, even if we can't get the exact training sessions that we want to in the gym, or we can't quite eat the way that we would like to because we're traveling. And I think that if we challenge ourselves appropriately and we build capacity in the system, whichever system that is, we will then have resilience to suboptimal conditions and be able to perform in suboptimal conditions, which is actually the reality that most of us are going to face. We're just not going to be able to optimize anything, but we want to still be able to perform well when things are suboptimal. And that's kind of the cognitive approach that I would take to trying to solve that problem.
I feel like I've met my long-lost brother here. Because I teach on building adaptive capacity, right? Like, you just want to build capacity for more stress.
Yeah.
So that you can, like, with elite athletes, like, you're talking about Formula One, right? I thought that was a great analogy because you're racing on a weekly basis. When I worked in the NFL, it's, you know, every Sunday, and 16 games is rough on the human system. These guys go through a train wreck. The idea is to have minimal perturbations. And these are not optimal scenarios. Travel, flights, throwing your body in a meat grinder, practicing during the week, psychological stress outside of work, like all these different things. It's hard to insulate yourself. But I think really what most people want is just to feel good most of the time. And I really love this approach to things. So biohackers beware. I'm not a big fan of biohacking. This isn't something you hack. It's something you develop. And it's a biological system and it's a biological process. There's stress, rest, and adaptation. And there's going to be times where reality hits. And I really appreciate your measured approach to this. The cold tub is not going to solve all your problems. There's bigger fish to fry, so to speak. If you enjoyed today's episode with Dr. Wood, be on the lookout. We've got two more coming. We're going to be talking about the impact of social media on our health. We'll also be talking about brain health, and how sugar and alcohol and other things can impact it. Until next time, stay curious, stay consistent, and keep chasing excellence.